First You Think is a not-for-profit ministry of the First Unitarian Church of Des Moines. Support us at ucdsm.org today.
Love and ethics. That touches on two of the three prongs of our mission, what we're here for. We're here to grow ethically as well as spiritually, and we're here to love radically. Ethics and love. I want to explore today the overlap. How do ethics and love relate to each other? I learned at a young age from the Gospel of John Lennon that all you need is love. Is that true? The Beatles sang it, but then they also sang, "I am the walrus, nothing is real, happiness is a warm gun, and we all live in a yellow submarine." So maybe not everything they sang is true. Yes, certainly in addition to love, we need things like air, food, water, shelter, but looking just at the ethical realm, to be a good person, to be a moral, ethical person, is love all we need? Is love all you need as your guide for how to act? I'm going to say, actually, yes. Love, including attentive care to be as effectively compassionate as we can be, is all we need. The counter viewpoint, generally accepted, is that to act rightly in the world, it's necessary to have moral principles. However, what I'm suggesting to you today is, never mind principles. Just love. Love is the only law, as sources as disparate as Ziggy Marley and Nisargadatta Maharaj have said. Making the case against principles may be a bit of a heavy lift. Let us jump in and see what can be carried. We all face ethical decisions. Do I speak up or remain quiet? When is it time to put mom in a nursing home or time to let go of a child? Am I prioritizing my time in a way that most benefits myself and others in the long run? Is the comfort I get from bumping the thermostat a couple degrees higher or the enjoyment of eating meat worth the damage to the planet? Does it really matter if my coffee is or isn't fair trade, or if my shirt was or wasn't made in a sweatshop, or if some product was or wasn't tested on animals? Whenever you choose to do or not do anything, there's the question of whether that choice is the right one. The great ethical traditions have defended ethical principles. Immanuel Kant propounded the principles, "So act that the maxim of your action may be willed a universal law for all." In other words, before you do something, ask yourself, what if everybody did that? Kant's ethics also tell us to treat others never as a means only, but as ends in themselves. The utilitarians argue that instead, the only test of the goodness of an action is the goodness of its results. Their ethical principle is, so act to maximize the total happiness or the total benefit to all beings. And the third great ethical school is virtue ethics, which is rooted in Aristotle. This school of ethics says that to be a good person, you cultivate virtues, such as courage, which we'll be looking at next month, since courage is our theme of the month for May, and justice, i.e. treating people fairly, and temperance and prudence. These are philosophical approaches to ethics, and I will say, as a former philosophy professor, that philosophers are occasionally worth paying attention to. Your brain, like mine, is a mishmash of competing, contradictory ideas, concepts, values, and beliefs. Cognitive dissonance sometimes surfaces, but whenever we can keep it out of mind, we do. Becoming conscious of cognitive dissonance feels icky, uncomfortable, to be avoided if possible. But a philosopher is somebody who goes looking for the dissonance. Philosophers concoct all manner of bizarre, unrealistic, hypothetical examples just for the purpose of inducing dissonance. Example, suppose that either five people had to die or one person had to die. Which would be better? Clearly, it would be better for one person to die than for five, right? Okay, so suppose you have five people who are dying of different organ failures. One of them needs a heart transplant, another needs a liver transplant, another needs two kidneys, and another needs lungs, another needs pancreas and intestines. Would it be okay to kill one healthy person, harvest his organs, and distribute them to among the five? No. But wait, one person dying is better than five. See, the philosopher's job is to induce cognitive dissonance, which is uncomfortable. As we confront the issue of how we live our lives, we like to think that we have moral principles that guide us. We imagine ourselves to be principled people. We would hate to be accused of being unprincipled. To live by principle seems an admirable thing. Moral principles keep you on the righteous, straight and narrow, irrespective of how you might feel about it. Principles do not depend on your emotions. You don't have to love your neighbor to know you shouldn't steal from her. But on the other hand, if you do love your neighbor, maybe you don't need principles. Philosopher Jonathan Dancy is a champion of an approach to ethics called moral particularism. Dancy argues that ethics isn't really about having principles and following them. Here's the opening paragraph of Dancy's article about moral particularism in the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. Moral particularism, at its most trenchant, is the claim that there are no defensible moral principles. That moral thought does not consist in the application of moral principles to cases. And that the morally perfect person should not be conceived as the person of principle. There are more cautious versions, however. The strongest defensible version perhaps holds that though there may be some moral principles, still the rationality of moral thought and judgment in no way depends on a suitable provision of such things. And the perfectly moral judge would need far more than a grasp on an appropriate range of principles and the ability to apply them. Moral principles are, at best, crutches that a morally sensitive person would not require. And indeed, the use of such crutches might even lead us into moral error. End quote. Jonathan Dancy and moral particularism were featured on an episode of the NBC comedy The Good Place a few years ago. The Good Place is about four people in the afterlife who are trying to become better by studying ethics. I mentioned this show in a sermon back in September, which also had the same graphic on your order of service. These four want to deserve to be in the good place, and their strategy is to study ethics. It's hilarious. They talk about Kant and Sartre and utilitarianism and Kierkegaard and John Rawls. They mention names and ideas of people that you'd have to be a total philosophy nerd to have ever heard of. Philippa Foote, Tim Scanlon, as well as this Jonathan Dancy. They talk about the scenario I mentioned of killing one person to save five. The cognitive dissonance that drives philosophy turns out to be more tolerable when it's funny. I do love the concept here, although the evidence, unfortunately, does not support the idea that studying ethics, studying texts of moral philosophy, has much real connection to being a better person. Studies of actual ethics professors show that they are not more likely to be courteous, more likely to vote, more likely to give to charities, more likely to be vegetarian, or less likely to slip into conferences without paying the conference dues than any other academic. In fact, a survey of which books go missing from academic libraries shows that ethics books go missing more than any other philosophy books matched in age and popularity. So studying ethics may not help you be more ethical. Still, it might be the case that a life of learning in any field is apt to make us better people. Indeed, most of us feel that learning is in itself a component of a good life. The characters in The Good Place seeking to become better people might just as well have taken up the study of economics or chemistry. They happen to have chosen moral philosophy, and I guess that might work as well as anything would. Just trying to learn is becoming better. The show's protagonists do confront moral dilemmas, and it's nice to see sitcom characters employing the vocabulary of moral philosophy as they wrestle with what to do. As one reviewer wrote, "The Good Place stands out for dramatizing actual ethics classes on screen without watering down the concepts being described." The show ran for 4 seasons, and by the 2nd season, Chidi, who had been an actual ethics professor in life, has settled into the role of serving as the ethics tutor for the other 3, Eleanor, Tahani, and Jason. Also, Chidi and Eleanor have an on-again, off-again romantic relationship going. In the 11th episode of the 2nd season, Chidi declares himself a Kantian. Chidi has talked about Kant more or less sympathetically in many of the episodes, but without committing himself unequivocally. And now our heroes are trying to get to the judge, who they hope will rule favorably on their case. To get there, they have to go through the bad place and make their way through a room full of demons who are having what is essentially a cocktail party. Our heroes must impersonate demons in order to make it through this demon party. They must hide their true identities. They will need to lie. So Chidi says,
"I hate this. I hate lying. It's not permissible. I can't do this. Kant says that lying is always wrong, and I follow that maxim. Principles aren't principles when you pick and choose when you're going to follow them."
Later on, when our heroes have arrived at the cocktail party in hell and are trying to last it out without being discovered, Chidi manages to pull Eleanor aside for a moment of private conversation.
"Those bro demons over there think I'm some kind of great torturer. They want advice on how to torture someone. Help me."
"You know the answer, dude. Lie your ass off."
"No, lies have consequences. I will have contributed to someone's eternal torture because I disobeyed a basic Kantian principle. I'm going to be sick, and I don't want to go back to the bathroom because they put mirrors in the toilet, and that makes you really confront what you're doing."
Okay, sit down. Take a breath, grab your lucky bookmark, and hear me out. What if lying is, in this situation, ethical? What if there are no set... What if certain actions aren't universally good or bad, like Jonathan Dancy says?
Jonathan Dancy? Are you talking about moral particularism? We never even covered that. You read on your own?
You think because I'm a straight hottie, I can't read philosophy for fun? Look, moral particularism says that there are no fixed rules that work in every situation. Like, say you promise your friends you'd go to the movies, but then your mom gets rushed to the ER. Your boy Kant says, never break a promise. Go see Chronicles of Riddick, and never mind if your mom gets lonely and steals a bucket of Vicodin from the nurse's closet.
Real example?
Yep. But a moral particularist, like me, I'm one now, I just decided, would say there's no absolute rule. You have to choose your actions based on a particular situation, and right now we're in a pretty bonkers situation.
I don't think I can change what I believe just like that.
And I didn't think I would ever be at a cocktail party in literal hell lecturing my teacher slash ex-lover about moral particularism. But life throws you curveballs, bro.
And life does throw us curveballs. And we get that there's something noble about the principled stand. That, as Chidi says, principles aren't principles when you pick and choose when you're going to follow them. But Immanuel Kant was just wrong. Moral principles can't be absolute. Generally, lying and breaking promises are wrong. The moral ideal is to avoid these as much as possible. But if you are a Gentile homeowner in Holland in the early 1940s and you have a family of Jews hiding in your attic when Nazi stormtroopers come around asking questions, it's time to lie. And as in Eleanor's example, when your mom has just been rushed to the ER, it's time to break your promise to see a movie with a friend at that time. Sometimes principles conflict with each other. The principle of protecting life or supporting one's mother in her time of need might conflict with the principles of not lying and not breaking promises. Conflicting principles can't all be absolute. Could the principles maybe be ranked in order of importance so that only one principle ranked at the top is truly absolute? And if that one is satisfied, then you move to the second, and if that is satisfied, on down to the third, and so on. When principles conflict, you follow the one that is higher ranked. The problem with this approach is that it supposes that satisfying a principle is an all or nothing thing. But principles tend to be variably satisfiable. There's a difference between saying something slightly misleading and telling a bald-faced whopper. We might protect life a little bit, or we might protect it a lot. So if a given action would violate the top-ranked principle a little bit, but not doing that action would violate the second-ranked principle a lot, then maybe it's the second principle that should govern in that case. And once we admit that possibility, then it's useless to try rank ordering the principles. Can we have principles without making them absolute or rank ordering them? Some philosophers take this approach, seeing moral principles as contributory rather than absolute. For example, in deciding what to say, contributory principles might be, is it true? Is it necessary? And is it kind? One might take the position that any two of the three is sufficient. If it is necessary and kind, then it need not be true. If it is necessary and true, then it need not be kind. And if it is kind and true, then it need not be necessary. Each of the principles contributes, but none is absolute, and they aren't ranked. The moral task is to balance the contributions of various principles that apply to the given situation. But at this point, are they really principles? Chidi says principles aren't principles when you pick and choose when you're going to follow them. But is pick and choose any different from balance the contributions of various principles? Pick and choose sounds capricious. And now I think we're getting at what's really at stake. We don't like to think of ourselves as unprincipled because we think of unprincipled as capricious or self-serving or both. And love is indeed the answer to both of these worries. Love manifests as care for others and a steady commitment to care. Caprice is what happens when we haven't found our way to or have lost our way from our commitments of care. Self-serving is being negligent about appropriate care of others' concerns and needs. It's a failure of love. What we mostly do, and that love attunes us to do better, is take in the details of the situation. Various details provide reasons for doing this or doing that, and when those details are seen in the light of love, including love for ourselves, then we are guided to respond in compassion and in care. Every situation is full of reasons, that is, details relevant for discerning how to respond. We need to attend to those reasons, but Jonathan Dancy's moral particularism says we don't need principles. What we know about human behavior is that, by and large, in fact, we do not follow principles. Nor does talking about principles and declaring allegiance to them, studies find, make people act better. It doesn't stiffen up waning resolve, just as studying ethics doesn't make people more ethical. As Dancy writes, there's only one real way to stop oneself from distorting things in one's own favor, and that is to look again as hard as one can at the reasons present in the case and see if really one is so different from others that would be required of them is not required of oneself. This method is not infallible, I know, but then neither was the appeal to principle. Look again, as hard as one can, at the reasons present in the case. Pay attention. Notice. But what is the energy that we need for attending to the details of what's going on? We will be able to attend just so far as we care, so far as we love. Love this life. Love this world. Love each other, our fellow travelers. Love is the fuel for caring attention, and it is caring attention, not moral principles, that guides us in discerning what to do. As we love more, we pay attention more, notice more, and thus more fully respond, bringing more of who we are to more of what the world needs. All you need is love. All the world needs is your love. Our four protagonists in The Good Place, trying to become better people by studying ethics, do, over the course of four seasons, gradually become better people. But you will notice, if you see or have seen the show, they become better people through their commitment to each other, through their burgeoning capacity to love. All you need is love. All you need is love indeed. May it be so. Blessed be, and amen.